This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Welcome to the December episode, listeners. I'm news editor Ezzy Pearson, and I'm joined on the podcast today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later in the episode, I'll be talking to Apostolos Christou about his discovery of a moon-like asteroid in the same orbit of Mars. And we'll be telling you our top stargazing tip to see in this month's night sky. But for now, we're going to take a look at what we found out whilst we were putting together the December issue of the magazine. And this month, we decided to take a look back and a look forward at a mission that is currently going through the outskirts of our solar system, New Horizons. As many of you know, might recognise the name, it flew past Pluto back on the 14th of July in 2015, so 5 years ago now. But that wasn't the end of its mission, far from it. Ever since, it has been shooting out into the outskirts of the solar system and is currently 7.2 billion kilometres away, which is quite far away.
It's pretty far away. It doesn't feel like it was 5 years ago, does it?
It doesn't at all. It's especially because we've had because you hear about it every so often, because it took so long for the data to get back from New Horizons. So New Horizons flew past Pluto on the 14th of July, 2015, as I said. Its closest approach was at 11:49 GMT, and it approached within 12,472 kilometres of the surface, which, when you're talking flybys, that's pretty close. It had to go through, there was a 22-hour wait as it flew past, because it wanted to focus all of its attention onto the surface of the dwarf planet, onto the surface of Pluto. And it couldn't send any signals back. So there was, I remember, because I was reporting on it at the time, that sort of weight of, like, has it been a success? Has it been hit by some piece of debris? Are we ever going to hear from it again? But we did. And then on the 15th of July, we started getting all of these incredible images back from it. But it's taken the spacecraft, 15 months to download all of its data. And that's not because it had a lot of data. It only took about 6 gigabytes of information. So for reference, that's about the same as one or two high definition films if you download them off the internet. And yet it took so long because the distance was so far and it had barely any power to be able to send this back. So it took a long, long time. And that means people are still going through all of this information and probably still will be for another couple of years.
I mean, I think it's incredible to think in spite of that, in spite of the difficulties, I suppose, of getting the information back, that we did actually manage to get those amazing images, you know, along with the data. And I think, you know, for most people, the thing that will stand out most is that incredible heart-shaped region on Pluto, you know, just that amazing, as it was kind of almost like the first glimpse you know, as the spacecraft was approaching Pluto, that was really what stands out, doesn't it? Just that heart-shaped region.
Yes, because even though the closest approach happened, you know, on the 14th, the entire, like, 2 weeks leading up, as the spacecraft got closer and closer, it was getting able to resolve. First of all, it was just this point of light. Then it was, you could see it was a ball, and then you could start making out things on its surface. And even from a couple of days away, you could start seeing that heart, the heart of Pluto. And it was just really exciting watching this sort of getting ever closer and closer and closer. And actually, that heart is as well as being, you know, a beautiful, because the pictures that came back from Pluto were absolutely stunning. But everybody was expecting to get to Pluto and find it was just this dead ball of ice because it's so far away from the sun. How could it possibly, you know, it just didn't have the energy to be able to do like things like volcanic processes. And yet there was this great big white heart, which looks like a massive glacier of nitrogen that they now think is about 4 kilometers thick. So in fact, it's so big that it's actually started pulling Pluto around to face its moon, Charon. And nobody was expecting to see that, this incredibly dynamic surface. You know, there's evidence that there's a liquid water ocean below the surface of Pluto, that there's volcanism going on, that it might be tectonically active. And all of that requires, like, quite a lot of energy that people just weren't expecting to find on this planet so far from the sun.
But isn't that volcanism isn't that cryovolcanism? We're not talking lava, are we? We're talking sort of ice.
Yes, that's a very important distinction, actually. Thank you. We're talking cryovolcanism. So this is when you're getting that cold, because even though it's far away and it's energetic, it's very, very cold because it's so far away from the sun. And at those temperatures, water and even things like nitrogen start acting completely differently. Nitrogen isn't a gas, it's a liquid. Ice gets so hard, it acts more like rock than it does ice that we know on this planet. And so, yes, you get this kind of like volcanism cycle, but instead of it being molten rock and molten lava, it's molten nitrogen and molten water and water rocks. Which I've always loved, cryovolcanism. I think it's this it's just wonderfully strange and alien and yet somehow familiar.
Yeah, exactly. Like when you talk about, you know, the volcanoes on Jupiter's moon Io, you know, you can kind of imagine what that might be like because we have volcanoes on Earth. But when you think of ice volcanoes, you just think that's just absolutely mind-blowing. That's just such a cool thing that we've been able to discover in the solar system.
I can't remember if it was Alan Stern, who's the head of New Horizons, or Ed Stone, who's the head of Voyager. But I was interviewing them once and they said one of the things that we find every time we take another step out into the solar system is we always find something completely strange and unusual that nobody was expecting to find. You know, no one expected to find cryovolcanoes on the icy moons of Jupiter until Voyager flew by and saw it, and no one was expecting Pluto to be active until we flew by it and saw it. And just every time we take a new look at a new place in the solar system, we're just blown away by how strange and frequently how wrong we are about our ideas of what it's like out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that you're kind of mentioning Voyager there, because I think I'm pretty sure it was Carl Sagan who said that, you know, after Voyager, you know, the planets are no longer just sort of orbiting distant points of light. You know, like we now know what they look like close up pretty much, and we know a lot more about them. And you definitely get that from the New Horizons mission, don't you? Because as you said, you might have expected Pluto to be this sort of dead ball of ice, but in fact it's shown that it's quite geologically active. I mean, I was reading about there's cellular ice features that New Horizons discovered, and they're about 50 kilometers across, and some of them could be as young as like a million years old, which when you consider, the age of the solar system, that's still quite young. And they've got these so this kind of like smooth in the middle and rough around the edges, so they think that might be like convective nitrogen flow, with the heat from the heat from below the surface is causing nitrogen to rise in the center and, you know, and then kind of fall at the edges.
Yeah, it's there's some incredibly complex things going on the surface of Pluto. Because that's one of the things I always find when you're looking at something like geology is just like how much everything interacts and feeds into each other. Yeah. And, you know, it's like the state of the ground and how thick the crust is and then what's going on below the surface and the way it interacts with the atmosphere. And there's just so many different things going on that can change what happens on the what happens.
Yeah, but also, I suppose, as well as nitrogen, there was a lot of sort of methane ice discovered, wasn't there? And that was kind of one of the big discoveries of New Horizons at Pluto.
Mm. Yes, a lot of methane, a lot of what they call organic molecules. So organic, to be clear, doesn't mean the same as biological. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was created by life, but it is one of the things that one of the ingredients that we believe you need to make life. And whilst nobody's expecting to find life on Pluto, it's one of those markers that we like to track, that people like to track, because it explains how those ingredients got to Earth and potentially where they are on other planets where they might form life. And one of the interesting things that they found was that there was, because Pluto has a moon called Charon. And the moon is about half the size of the planet. So it's relative to each other. They're pretty well matched. It's almost kind of that there are, some people say they're a binary system. So it's not really a planet and a moon. Sorry, a dwarf planet. Need to be careful about that one. A dwarf planet and a moon. they're actually orbiting each other. But they interact a lot. So Pluto has a very thin atmosphere, which sometimes strays across to Charon. And that's why when you look at the moon, Charon, it has this kind of reddish tinge that people were struggling to explain at first. And now people think it might be from organic chemicals raining onto it from Pluto. So Pluto's atmosphere is kind of being sucked onto Charon and it interacts and forms these organic chemicals on the surface.
Wasn't that to do with the sort of methane being hit by sunlight? Because I'd read that part of the rusty red colour that we see in Pluto in those New Horizons images was like organic materials called tholins, and they occur when sunlight reacts with frozen methane.
That is, I think it's the current leading theory is that there's something called tholins, which is just a very specific kind of organic molecule that happens to be red. And yes, it's caused by light interacting and affecting methane.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but they did also find evidence of water ice, didn't they? Apparently on the highest peaks of Sputnik Planitia, which is the sort of western lobe of the heart, they found actual evidence of water ice.
As I wouldn't be surprised, because like I said, it's water starts acting like rock. So yeah, it's you would be expected to kind of like find mixed in with the sort of the main body of Pluto, sort of what makes it up, there's probably going to be some water ice in there.
Yeah, and I think kind of one of my favorite discoveries was that there's like a big deep canyon system, which apparently is a lot bigger than the Grand Canyon. So it's 700 kilometers long and 9 kilometers deep, this huge canyon system on Pluto. I mean, it just as you were saying, you know, it just brought the planet to life, didn't it? You know, for us back on Earth.
Yeah, I always think that's one of the strange things, because on Earth, because we have things like tectonic plates and weather, even our biggest geological features, they don't get the chance to get that big, because then basically the planet changes before they have the chance to grow. So even our kind of, you know, like our Grand Canyon and our Mount Everest, when you compare it to like the other mountains and canyons in the solar system, they're tiny. They're not anything. They're nothing to write home about.
Yeah, but I suppose it's worth talking about the, you know, New Horizons mission post-Pluto. So on the 1st of January 2019, New Year's Day, it was a pretty cool time to be doing it. Most of us were probably either still in bed or reading from the night before. New Horizons performed this close encounter with a Kuiper Belt object. And so yeah, so the Kuiper Belt object is this edge of the disk out of which the solar system formed. So about 5 billion years ago, there was a giant molecular cloud started collapsing. Out of this formed the sun and the planets in orbit. To cut a long story short, and the Kuiper Belt is this outer disk of these icy, dusty rocks and other bodies, and they're essentially primordial relics. So there's the sort of primordial relics left over from the solar system's formation, and the idea after Pluto was to go and take a look up close at one of these Kuiper Belt objects. I mean, you know, I suppose it's worth pointing out that Pluto is not considered a Kuiper Belt object, isn't it? You know, so I suppose Pluto was the first Kuiper Belt object that, you know, we had a close encounter with. But the one that they looked at after Pluto was a kind of medium to small one. It was called Ultima Thule for a long time, but it's since been renamed to 486958 Arrakoth. And it's this sort of a snowman-shaped rock. First Kuiper Belt ever flown by, if you don't include Pluto. And it's sort of important to do, you know, it was an important undertaking, I suppose, because to get the chance to do it, because, as I said, you know, these are sort of primordial relics of the solar system. So the more you learn about those Kuiper Belt objects, the more you potentially learn about what the early solar system was like, maybe potentially how it formed, how it's evolved over time. Because Arrakoth is known as a cooled Kuiper Belt object, which means that its orbit hasn't really changed. It formed where it is, and it stayed there largely untouched for about 4.6 billion years. Although I suppose, you know, it's not as if it's going to be utterly pristine, is it? Because it'll still get bombarded by radiation from the sun and things like that, won't it?
Yeah, it's getting bombarded by radiation from the sun. Also, it's getting bombarded by other Kuiper Belt objects. I think that was one of the things that they found out about it, because, as you said, it's this snowman, so it's got like these two lobes, they're called, but it's basically like two lumps stuck together. And they look like they've been sort of been through the same thing.
Yeah.
So they're a similar colour. They've got the same amount of impact craters and so much on them. So they think they probably formed at about the same time rather than sort of coming together at a later date.
Yeah, and that collision, because I think it was around about this time last year, I think, I was interviewing Kerry Liss, who was one of the New Horizons scientists who was kind of involved in that Kuiper Belt flyby. And he said that they worked out that the two lobes, so they're about 9 and 7 kilometers across, respectively, and they were separate lobes that then joined. And he said that they probably collided at speeds of a few millimeters per second.
Yeah.
So hardly anything. And he said that there was a joke going around the New Horizons team at the time, which was if you want to recreate the collision that formed Arrakoth, just walk into a wall. Which obviously we don't suggest that anyone does, but it's quite a nice image. But yeah, I suppose it's worth just pointing out the sort of logistics of the flyby. So its closest approach was 3,500 kilometers from the object, and it was traveling about 14 kilometers per second. You know, so when you consider,
so that's actually, it got closer than it to Arrakoth than it did to Pluto.
Yeah, exactly. But still, you know, when you consider, you know, at that distance, traveling 14 kilometers per second, to be able to get what all the data that they did, you know, the amazing images, and they took spectra and radio measurements, and they were able to measure how the solar wind, this as we said, you know, this kind of bombardment of charged particles from the sun, how it sort of interacts with the surface of Arrakoth, and the effect that has, and it all ultimately pertains and comes back to this idea of just learning more about the chemistry and sort of what's going on out there, so that you can get a better piece of you know, these relics of the solar system and how they've changed and what that tells you about what the early solar system might have been like.
Yeah, it's, I don't, whenever you sort of read about the actual logistics of kind of, because you sort of hear about it, it's like, oh yes, they flew past the planet, they took some pictures. Of course, that's perfectly straightforward. Everybody can do that. But then you actually think about it, and it's like trying to take pictures of something right on the horizon when you're driving past it at 70 miles an hour in a speeding car kind of thing. It's just when you actually sort of think of the logistics of it, it's amazing that they managed to do any of this.
I know. And as we said, you know, not just images, but all that data that's still yet to be sifted through and still downloading. That's the thing that they were saying, is that it's sort of like the old dial-up internet, if anyone remembers that, you know, when you used to hear the telephone line crackle. It's that sort of speed.
Yeah.
So they just have basically waiting for a long, long time for it to all come back to Earth and they can study it.
Because one of the reasons why it takes so long is partly because it's far, but also because New Horizons can't have solar panels because it's too far away from the sun. There's no point. So instead, it's got something called a radiothermal generator, which basically uses a lump of radioactive material as a hot brick and converts that heat into energy, heat into power, which means it has barely any electricity to power its radio to send it back. So it's trying to send these signals back across enormous, enormous distances with this piddling little radio, basically. It's just like if you were trying to do that the other way around, you'd like build a power station to power the thing. But yeah, you can't do that on a spacecraft. You can't fit it on.
And, you know, and that's, it's even more incredible thinking about that when you consider that, you know, the mission's not over. It's still going. It's still, because it's still collecting data. It's still collecting, it's looking at new Kuiper Belt objects, isn't it? And it's sort of mapping radiation and interplanetary dust and hydrogen and it's still going.
In fact, the reason why we talk about it in the December issue is because it is, in December, it's going to be starting a new campaign, a new project. It's going to be using its lorry camera. This is its sort of long distance photography setup to look at 9 Kuiper Belt objects that are close by. NASA have tracked these down using Earth-based telescopes and the Hubble Space Telescope as well. But you can only get a certain angle from Earth because we're looking at them from so far away. So you can only really look at them dead on as they are to the sun. Whereas because New Horizons is in amongst them, it can look at them from the side and it can look at them obviously much closer as well. So it can let people look at, so it allows astronomers to be able to sort of see how the brightness changes as these things rotate, which is a great way to find out about their shape and their size. And possibly even find out a bit about what they're made of. So even though it's still going to be, you know, millions of kilometers away when it's doing these observations, it's going to be able to get a completely different look to what we'd ever be able to make on Earth.
And, you know, that's not forgetting. I mean, I was reading that apparently some of the objects that they're going to be looking at could be as much as 150 million kilometers away. So it's, you know, it's not going to be another flyby like Arakoth. It's not going to be that level, but it's still incredible that they can look at the shadow of something or the silhouette of an object that far away, and they can learn so much about, as you say, as how it's spinning, what it's shaped like, what its surface is made of, which potentially tells them whether or not it's being bombarded with micrometeoroids, which potentially tells them what the conditions are like in the Kuiper Belt, you know, for Kuiper Belt objects.
I always find it amazing because quite often when you're observing these things, all you can see is like it's like a pixel, maybe a couple across because they're so far away and so tiny. And yet even from that like one pixel, if you track it for long enough, you can tell so much information and really work out what's going on with these distant objects.
I know it's the same with exoplanets, isn't it? You know, like they can look at a dot going in front of a point of light, which is a exoplanet passing in front of its star, and they can work out like the mass and the density of the exoplanet and what it might be like, you know, whether it might be Earth-like or whether it's a gaseous giant. It's absolutely incredible. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah. And another thing that this mission will be doing is potentially looking out for another close flyby target, like with Arakoth. The New Horizons team aren't very confident that they'll find one. They think it's quite unlikely that they'll be able to find one that's within New Horizons, you know, fuel adjustment range. And also because New Horizons is almost at the very edge of the Kuiper Belt. It's only a couple of hundred a million kilometers away. And when you're talking billions of kilometers, that's not very far at all to go. So I think in the next couple of years, it's due to leave the Kuiper Belt and start heading out into the very, very outer edges of the solar system. But even then, its job won't be done. There are dozens and dozens of scientists out there who have all of these different requests for, can you look at this thing? Can you look at that thing? Can you turn New Horizons around and look back into the solar system once you get outside of the Kuiper Belt? Because, yeah, this is only the third spacecraft that's got out to that region and still be working and still sending data back out, back home. The other two...
That's so cool.
Yeah, the other two were the Voyager spacecraft and... They were incredible machines, and the fact that they're still going is phenomenal. But they were built in the 70s with very 70s technology, whereas New Horizons is a much, much more modern spacecraft and has much more modern instruments.
So if you think of that, the Voyager blue dot image, the pale blue dot image of, like, you know, the kind of the portrait of the solar system, it's as it's looking back, this will be a sort of portrait of the solar system from beyond the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah, that's the hope that they'll be able to take that, or something similar. I know that there's one team that wants to look back at the things like Jupiter and Saturn, because it's very, very thin, but there is a kind of atmosphere. There is gas within the inner solar system that, once you're beyond the Kuiper Belt, you're outside of that bubble and you can see through it, and there's people wanting to investigate that sort of thing. So I'm actually really looking forward to seeing what New Horizons has to do and what New Horizons is going to get to see in the next coming decade or so, until it finally runs out of power, which I think is due sometime around 2030. So it's still got a decade or so in it left.
Yeah, it's so cool when you think about New Horizons in that context, especially in the context of sort of, you know, Juno at Jupiter or Cassini at Saturn, you know. So, like, Cassini at Saturn was purposely deorbited into the planet and that's it, you know, goodbye. Whereas New Horizons, it's of the same era, it's the same sort of planetary explorative robotic probe, but it's going to be continuing on out into the solar system, sort of almost like representing humanity, you know.
Yeah, it's these just kind of set them flying and go and see where they end up. Which I think.
Yeah. So cool.
Now that we've taken a good look at the outer edges of our solar system, we're going to take a look at something slightly closer to home in our expert interview. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Apostolos Christou, an astronomer from the Armagh Observatory and Planetarium. And recently, Apostolos came across a rather unusual discovery about an asteroid in the same orbit as Mars. So, Apostolos, what was so special about this asteroid?
Hello, Elizabeth. Well, we've been looking at this group of asteroids that have been following Mars as a flock of sheep, if you like, might follow a shepherd. And I've been looking at one of those with a rather big telescope, and we've been trying to measure its color. That's useful to tell us about the composition of the asteroid, what sort of minerals might be up there. And what we found, strangely enough, it has a color very similar to our own moon, so it's almost a dead ringer for the moon, color wise, you might say.
And what does that mean for the asteroid? Did the asteroid start on the moon and somehow make its way to Mars?
Most of the asteroids we know out there the colors are not very different from the moon. You might be surprised to know that the moon is slightly red, although this will not register to the eye. And also, asteroids are slightly red as well. However, when you take precise measurements of the colors, you find that there are very important differences. How the amount of light that the asteroid reflects varies across the different colors. In this case, well, this asteroid is color-wise is much, much closer to the moon than it is for any other asteroid. Now, there could be a number of possibilities here. One, which is probably the most mundane one, but we cannot dismiss it without more information, is that this is just an ordinary humdrum asteroid that's just been out on the sun for too long, to be precise, for 4 billion years. Because of that, its color has been changed because of radiation from the sun. Okay, so the color actually, in that case, does not tell us so much about the composition of the asteroid, but how long it's been out there. A second possibility, here is where we're getting excited, is, well, it has the color of the moon because it came from the moon. Now, this is not possible to do now. You cannot launch an asteroid from the moon and expect it to be somehow locked to the Martian orbit in a stable way that like this asteroid is, because the asteroid doesn't have rockets. You know, it cannot change its trajectory. However, back at the beginning of the solar system, when the planets were forming, there were a lot of impacts on the moon. So there's a lot of material, you know, being dug out of the moon and flying out in all the different directions. So what could have happened is that one of those, like, shards, you know, like a shard of glass from a broken jar, ended up in the Martian orbit. This by itself is not difficult to do. But then what happened is that Mars still had not fully formed at that time. So what happened is, as Mars grew up in mass, it sort of locked the asteroid in its orbit, so it was now unable to go away. So if this is true, it tells us that this asteroid is actually quite old. It's a lot older than, for example, any of the asteroids that we know come near the Earth, which are at most about 100 million years old. This is, again, you know, in absolute terms, this is also very old, but not as old as 4 billion years. Finally, the asteroid could have come from Mars. Its color indicates the sort of minerals that we found in the upper layer of Mars, what we call the crust. And just like the moon, Mars also got pummeled by impacts early in its history. So if it's possible that the asteroid came from the moon, it's actually even more plausible that it came from Mars itself and then got locked in its orbit in the same way.
And you've been talking there a lot about the asteroid's colour and how it compares to the moon. Is there anything else that we know about the asteroid at the moment?
Okay, so the asteroid, we know this based on its brightness. It's quite small. It's about a kilometer across, so nothing to shout about. It also has an orbit that's, if you like, it's tilted to the orbit of the planets. Now, that's significant because if we want ever to go there, we have to change our orbit to match the orbit of the asteroid, and that's more difficult to do for this kind of tilted orbits. It takes more fuel.
If we do want to find out exactly, you know, where this asteroid originated, what kind of follow-up observations or investigations need to happen to sort of narrow that down?
Right. So what we could do in the near term, try to obtain the same sort of data that we've got, but higher quality, to give us a better handle of the shape of its spectrum, so to speak. And we can do that with telescopes that are actually about to go online in the next few years. One of them is the James Webb Space Telescope that's scheduled to launch upon an Ariane 5 rocket next year. And this actually can take really good spectra or color measurements of the asteroid in the near-infrared part of the spectrum. It's easier to distinguish between different minerals on the surface. However, if we really want to, find out once and for all where the asteroid came from, we really have to go out there and touch it. We may not necessarily have to bring a sample back, but even if we manage to land on it, and measure the chemical composition, this will tell us a great deal about where it may have come from.
Well, we've recently sent a bunch of missions to asteroids that aren't around planets, so maybe in the future we'll get one sending off to Mars.
There's always more asteroids than spacecraft out there, so I would like to remain optimistic that one day we'll be able to visit this asteroid, which could turn out to be the lost sibling to the moon.
Well, that is a lovely note to end on. So thank you very much for talking to us today, Apostolos.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
If you're planning on looking up at the night sky this month, we recommend taking the time to observe the Geminid meteor shower, which looks set to be one of the most spectacular of the year. The Geminids can be seen right the way through the first half of December, but will peak on the night of the 13th to the 14th of December at around 10 to 1 a.m. GMT. Because the moon will be nearly new, the sky will be much darker, allowing you to see even the dimmest of meteors. The best time to observe will be after midnight going on towards dawn. And to get the best view, you'll want to travel to a dark sky site, but current travel restrictions may mean you're not allowed to do so, so be sure to check before you go. If you can't get to a dark sky site, then anywhere you can get away from immediate sources of artificial light, such as a local park or your back garden, will still give you a good show. Just make sure it's safe and that you can keep warm, as you'll be spending a lot of time outside in the middle of December. Leave your telescope at home, as the best way to see meteor showers is with your naked eye. Put your phone or any other light source away and start looking up, taking in as much of the sky as you can. A sun lounger or reclining chair is ideal for this, as it will help prevent neck ache. After 20 minutes or so, you should notice that your eyes have adapted to the dark and you'll begin to see streaks of light shooting across the sky. Geminids are so called because they appear to emanate from the constellation Gemini. Find Gemini in the night sky, and if you manage to spot a meteor racing away from this point, chances are you've just seen a Geminid meteor.
So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about New Horizons in the December issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also take a look at the upcoming alignment of Jupiter and Saturn. Discover the incredible work by pioneering Scottish astronomer Mary Somerville. And all of our print copies this month come with our fabulous 2021 calendar, which features all of the best images from this year's Insight Investment Astronomy Photographer of the Year Awards. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, or Spotify.